Hello and welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the ninth of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George P. Shultz and features former Stanford University Hoover Institution Research Fellow Robert Conquest. Originally recorded in 2006, the two talk about U.S. relations with the Soviet Union during the Reagan era, sharing personal stories from that time in history. The discussion continues into more recent relations between Russia and the United States at that time. We hope you enjoy this week's episode, and be sure to stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
George, it's great to see you. I'm very much looking forward to your comments on everything. So, what do you want to start with?
Well, I think we should start with the Soviet Union, because that's a subject on which you have written so beautifully and deeply, and to all of us, the picture presented is appalling. But there it is. And you have expressed the reality. And I always felt that one of the strengths we had in the Reagan administration was the ability to be realistic. And the president was realistic about the Soviet Union and didn't kid himself. And that was a great asset, and you were a big contributor to that. And I think Margaret Thatcher also noticed your work.
Yes, she did indeed. I was very close to her on these matters. But the thing was, there was so much in the West which didn't know about it. So many in the West knew nothing about it. The men remained ignorant in spite of everything we knew. But you knew it all the time. But there was a huge number of people in the West who hid the truth from you as well as from everybody else.
Well, they didn't want to hear the truth.
No.
They wanted to believe that everything was going to be okay.
It would have been nice, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. But I had the advantage not only of being exposed to your work, but also during the Nixon administration, I was Secretary of the Treasury. And I made quite a few trips to the Soviet Union. And I dealt with the Soviets on the economic side of what President Nixon was doing. And my wife would go with me, my late wife, and she was a nurse. And she'd go and visit hospitals and things like that, and she'd come back and she'd be pale. And she would say, I could hardly wait to get out of the building. It was like it was going to fall down. And I wouldn't work there as a nurse. It's so unsanitary and so on. And you just knew that this was not a society that was a healthy one.
Well, she could see that.
She could see it.
And why so many people in the West couldn't, including, let me say, diplomats?
Well, I once went, after I'd been negotiating back and forth with the group there, I went for a weekend in the Black Sea. I was on my way from Nairobi to Moscow, and Ambassador Dobrynin, their ambassador in Washington, said, why don't you stop in Sochi and have a weekend? And I was taken to a very substantial, relatively new building, which was where we were to stay, and was obviously built on an old estate of some kind. And I remarked on what a solid building it was, and my person accompanying me said, well, we wanted to show you this so you wouldn't think that everything good in Russia was built by the Tsars. And I thought, what a revealing comment that is.
Well, one of the, not the same sort of thing, but one of the oddest things I came across in Moscow, we were being driven past a nice, well-built block. And I said, that looks a well-built block. Yes, it was built by German prisoners of war. That shows there's something wrong in the system. I mean, that wasn't
right.
Economically, it was wrong for some other reason. German prisoners weren't being paid anything. It was just, they had the habit of building it. How awful to think of.
We had an interesting moment here at Stanford when President Gorbachev visited us. He was still in office, and he came here to a certain extent to visit me because I'd gotten to know him pretty well. He stayed in the Soviet ambassador's residence in San Francisco. It was a beautiful day, and that residence looks out on San Francisco Bay and the Golden Gate Bridge. Then he rode down the beautiful Route 280, came in the Oval at Stanford, And he got out of the car and he looked at me. He said, George, I see you now live in paradise. But anyway, he had asked that there be a seminar with some Stanford luminaries. And so I arranged that. And I asked for everybody to assemble the day before to kind of go over what we would do. And to my surprise, people came. And one man was there who was an earthquake expert. And there had been an earthquake in San Francisco and a similar size one in Armenia. And in San Francisco, most things stayed up. And in Armenia, everything fell down. So the earthquake guy called me up and he said, suppose I say to Mr. Gorbachev, we had similar sized earthquakes, everything in San Francisco turned out okay, and everything fell down in Armenia. So I said, why don't you just say the first part, which he did. And Gorbachev, without skipping a beat, said, we had a similar sized earthquake in Armenia and everything fell down. And the reason is not because you know a lot more about engineering than we do. We've had earthquakes and we are pretty good engineers. You may know some things, but we understand that. Our problem is that we can't get people to build things according to the engineering specifications. That's why our buildings fell down. And I thought, again, it was a very revealing instant analysis by him of what was wrong.
Yes, I was at that meeting, and I was very much struck by Gorbachev. Here's somebody telling the truth about the Soviet Union, saying they fell down because we didn't keep the law.
Yeah.
The laws were not enforced.
Right.
That was the first time I'd heard anybody from Moscow to talk reality. I was absolutely astonished.
Well, I want to ask you a question. Gorbachev was unlike any of the Soviet leaders I had met before. And you can't help say to yourself, how did the Soviet system manage to produce at the top such a different personality? What do you think is the answer to that?
Well, I think they had a long years and years in which gradually the truth was coming through to the top. I think what one found was when you went there, that say the student grandchildren would know a certain amount that was gone wrong and gradually to seep upwards. And similarly, I think you say somewhere that the Shevardnadze, when he was foreign minister, why he was some good was he had actually had a job in Georgia which involved making decisions, whereas the top level, the Politburo and the foreign ministry, were cut off from reality completely. That was a different point. But they were cut off, but it gradually broke through. Eventually, Tatiana Zaslavskaya, a well-known sociologist, wrote a secret memorandum saying the economy was going to pieces, and it got through. We heard about it 20 years later, mm-hmm. Printed. But similarly, you remember, Shevardnadze said to Gorbachev, they were together on the beach at Putsumi, he said, this can't go on. I mean, if your seas start, your big lakes start drying up, you can't actually ignore it
right.
In quite the same way.
There, it's a physical fact in front of you. Well, if you take Gromyko, with whom I dealt a lot, somebody said when I took office that I had to be careful because he had such a great length of experience and he had dealt with X number of presidents and secretaries of state and so on. I said, well, he has a certain experience, but I have a different advantage. I've lived in my country. I've worked in my country. I've worked in universities. I've worked in businesses. So I know something about my country. And Gromyko really has had no experience in his own country. He's lived in the U.S. When he goes back, he's in a little cocoon.
Yeah.
And they shop in special places and they go to the same privileged areas. And they don't really have much of an idea of what the country's really like.
I think that's true. Brezhnev's daughter, niece, I think, was over here and wrote about that, saying Brezhnev and his people knew nothing about what was going on. They, as you say, they went to these special shops. But do you think they'd know? No, they didn't. They knew about it in theory, but they took it for granted. You could go to a special shop and get wonderful foreign food. Did you ever go to a local special shop, a local in, say, Vyazma or somewhere. I went, even these special shops were pretty bad by Western standards. Mm-hmm. These were the shops for the elite. Imagine what the ordinary people were living on.
But there was another incident that I had with them that made an impact on me. When I was in the economic arena, when I was Secretary of the Treasury in the early 1970s, I went there. And there was a guy named Patolichov, who was my opposite number. He was a tough old communist. I got to know him. He was a pretty good guy in his way. Anyway, after we'd gotten through negotiating in Moscow, we were to go to then called Leningrad. So to my surprise, he accepted a ride on my Air Force plane. So we're sitting on the plane, and he said, what would you like to see in Leningrad? And I said, well, I want to see the same thing everybody else wants to see. I want to go to the Hermitage. I want to see the Summer Palace. Blah, blah, blah. And he said, nyet. First, we go to the cemetery. So that's what we did. And we got to the cemetery, and there's kind of a place up above that you stand on, and you look down, and here's this big alleyway, and on each side are these huge mounds of mass graves. So we went down, and we walked down this middle place to the end where I laid a wreath. And while we're walking down, this funereal music is playing, and Patolichov is describing to me the Battle of Leningrad and the tremendous losses every family in the Soviet Union, he said, has had some, been touched by this immense battle. And pretty soon I noticed tears are streaming down his face. The interpreter that I'd gotten to know, they have very good interpreters in the Soviet Union, she dropped out, and I looked back, and she was in tears. Somebody else was interpreting. It was very moving. We got back to the place where we'd started, and I said to him, I also fought in World War II, and I had comrades shot down beside me, so I have a lot of sympathy with the people who are here. Then I walked to the front of this platform, and I got myself as straight as I could get, like a Marine. I'm a Marine. And I gave the Marine salute, and I did an about face. And I heard about that a lot from the Soviets as a measure of respect. And I think in dealing with them, it's there are a lot of problems, but you also had to respect the fighting quality, at least on their own soil. I never thought they were so good when they left their own soil. And I found that just that expression of respect gave me a lot of credibility. And they were much more willing to listen to what I had to say once I had done that.
Yes, I was attached to one of the Soviet armies towards the end of the war, Third Ukrainian Front in the Balkans. And I got to know the soldier in the street, as it were, pretty well, and they'd had a lot of losses. But they were, when you got to know them, they'd often say, yes, but my great uncle was killed in the false famine, in the party organized famine of 1933. And Alexander Yakovlev, who you knew, I'm sure, when he was here, he said he was in the front, in Leningrad front, I think, and he was wounded. But he said, he got one of the things made start to be a little anti-Soviet, before he started to be very anti-Soviet in the war, was that during the battles, not so much Leningrad but the others, they simply threw the infantry at the German positions. You know, because then the generals could say, I've had so many losses, I'm much better than you. he really used that. We got that from several people who were attached to the army, English and others. They said the army were fine, but the political officers and some of the commanders were simply, in the first place, they cheated. All the bad sides of Russia was in that, but not in the army itself, as you say.
I read a wonderful book about the Battle of Stalingrad and the massive fighting there. And On the one hand, Hitler was second-guessing his generals, and on the other hand, Stalin was second-guessing his generals. And both of them did very badly. It's just that Hitler did even worse than Stalin, that the Soviets won that battle. But it's right. If you had left it to the professionals, they'd have done a lot better.
Yes, I quite agree. I think what we don't often realize is it was a very near thing, that war. The Russian, not only at the beginning, in the Moscow battle, but as you say, in the Stalingrad area, it was nearly lost, in spite of the immense, which they don't talk about even now much, the immense number of American, 11 billion tons of steel went, Americans sent of steel and other. There was enormous, largely American input into the Russian war effort, which Zhukov recognized, but the politicians suppressed during the whole period after the war. But the other thing is, I think there is still one of the few things they still have, is a feeling, the old feeling, what was it called, military nationalism. Remember, you probably know this one better than I do, but it was quite a recent chief of staff, Kvashin, who caused the intervention of Russian troops during the war in Kosovo, when NATO was in Serbia.
Yes.
They flew these troops without provocation to try and cause trouble, that's all. And that feeling is still in part of the apparat, I think, part of the military apparat. They've given up Marxism, but they still have that old-fashioned military imperialism, a bit. Not everywhere, but it still exists.
Well, we are observing what's going on in Russia today. And it seems to me, if you're a student of history, you're not surprised to see Putin assuming more power, and you're not surprised to see these imperial instincts exerting themselves with respect to the Ukraine, with respect to Georgia and other places. That they call it the near abroad, but they want to make it nearer and nearer. Yeah. That's pretty obvious.
Well, they've given up universal attempt to turn the whole world into communism, and the whole theory is gone, but they still have that, even if it's only local or semi-local, as you say, like in Moldova and places. It's a bad, difficult habit to get out of.
I was in Moscow in October of 2005, so not long ago. And the traffic is the worst I've ever seen. And there are lots of cars now. It didn't used to be in the old days. The only cars were the big shots limousines going hither, thither, and here. But now it's full of cars. And they haven't learned how to control traffic.
No.
So people come to an intersection, and they go as far as they can into the intersection, and the light changes, they're there, and the people who want to go this way can't go, and everything gets blocked.
Traffic is...
But it's also true, there's a lot of enterprise there, and you see there's a tremendous amount of creativity, people who are smart and ingenious, but... The corruption, as far as I can see, is almost unbelievable. It's so widespread. And one manager of a company said in our meeting, said, the last time I wanted to build something, I had to get 126 sign-offs. So no doubt he had to pay for each one. So that's pretty bad.
Well, that's pretty bad, but mind you, that existed in the last decade or two of the Soviet Union as well. It was highly corrupt, it was quiet. Now it's fairly open. Mm-hmm. Then it went through the time when the corrupt people were fighting each other, when they had hired gangsters to shoot each other down. That seems to have eased off. It seems to become establishment, their corruption. But it does mean that their economic system hasn't worked since these points were made in the 12th century, 13th century. They're made by the British ambassador in Petersburg in the 1790s, saying, everybody, if you have a profit, you have to take it now or the state will steal it. And they only had a real merchant bank, you know better than I do, in about 1850. they never got over, either the left or the right, the idea that if there's any transaction, there's a winner and a loser. The notion that you cooperate both usefully, like trade, is missing.
As we think of trade, it only takes place if everybody gains. Well, otherwise you wouldn't trade.
Well, you tried to teach them that. You gave a great seminar in Moscow, what amounted to a seminar of the leadership.
Yes, I was told that I was conducting a classroom in the Kremlin by people who were critical. But anyway, Gorbachev liked it. And he loved to talk about ideas, and he was different. But it seems to me there are all these paradoxical things. There's great creativity there. There's great music and dance. Novelists have produced wonderful things. And so you have this sense of a country that has tremendous ability. And of course, at least as I saw it, I never thought the economy was what people estimated it to be. But you can't get away from those ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads on them. Mm-hmm. So you had to take that very seriously, particularly since with their type of government, they could have mobile big SS-18s that were very difficult to track and take out. So they were a formidable adversary. And I think that was one of the President Reagan understood that. And that's why he put so much emphasis on a defense against the ballistic missile. That if you could learn how to do that, you'd change the scene tremendously.
I think you and Reagan really saw not only what the Soviet Union was trying to do, but how to stop them. It wasn't the same thing. Because they said quite openly that Gromyko said our policy is to forward the revolutionary process throughout the world in the formal public speech. And Brezhnev said, on the other hand, we want to have more détente, because the less America or England feel threatened, the country could move the more left. If we threaten them too much, they get more right wing. So they never solved that one.
Right.
Because they produced this détente, and they had to give in on some things, but not much. We got stuff out of them and we blocked them. But that's what you could do. They never had the economy to compete.
I think that people don't quite realize the conceptual difference between the way President Reagan thought about this problem and the way it was thought about by most others. The idea of détente, which you mentioned, was we're here, they're there, that's life, and now the name of the game is how do we get along peacefully?
Yes.
And Reagan said, no, that's not right. Yeah. We're here, and they are a country that's going to be consigned to the ash heap of history. They're not stable. Yeah. They have powerful weapons. So we need to deal with them, but don't make the assumption that they're going to be there forever. They aren't.
They won't.
And then the other thing in which he parted company was the idea of linkage. And you remember when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, President Carter said he was shocked, and he learned more in the last few days about the Soviet Union than earlier in his life, and he shut off everything. No contacts. Couldn't go to the Olympics. Couldn't do anything. Everything was linked to Afghanistan. And President Reagan didn't agree with that approach. For one thing, if you say that you'll do something over here, if they do something over here, then they'll do something bad in the human rights area and then let go of it, and you're supposed to compensate them for that, play that game. So he didn't want to play that game. So by contrast, when they shot down a Korean airliner, we led the charge in condemning that and trying to do something about it. And President Reagan was asked if he was surprised, the way Jimmy Carter was, and he said, no, what do you expect of an evil empire? And so the fact that he wasn't surprised meant that he had much more flexibility of action. And we sent our arms control negotiators rather ostentatiously back to Geneva. So it was a different conceptual approach that Reagan used, based on more realism.
I think one can find that in your dealings with the Russians. When they said, we must have the solution this year, and you and Reagan said, no, we'll wait another year. We don't care. It worked. They thought they'd got you into a corner. You couldn't argue.
Well, President Reagan loved negotiation. Yeah. He did a lot of it when he was head of the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah, yeah.
And he and I used to talk negotiating stories. And of course, one of the things you know if you've done any negotiation is that if the other side sees that you're anxious for a settlement, you're not going to get a good settlement. So sometimes we were criticized for not making deals more quickly. And we said, well, we're interested in making a deal, but only if it's a good deal. We're not interested in a bad deal just for the sake of a deal.
Reagan's background reminds me of Ernest Bevin when I was in the Foreign Office in England. He was foreign minister. He'd been in the right, what would they call right wing of Labour, as a head of a big trades union. So, and when he was negotiating with Moscow, he said, this chap Molotov, he talks like a bloody communist. He'd come across them in negotiation. And of course, Reagan had it in Hollywood, I imagine.
Yes, he did.
So he knew how they had something to. Had some background.
Right.
And even before he went into foreign affairs. No, Reagan was extraordinary. The first time I met Reagan, when he just failed to get the nomination from Ford, a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
And they asked me in London, saying near the American embassy, and I saw him for about 2 or 3 hours. And my impression was twofold. One, that he had perfectly clear ideas, but he didn't think he knew if he wanted, when he talked something, he wanted to find out things. Now, I've come across so many politicians who have ideas and think they know everything.
Right.
But he had perfectly sound, sensible, everything perfectly genuine or very clear enough, but he wanted to know more.
Well, and we have seen in these essays that our Hoover colleagues, Kyron Skinner, Marty, yeah. and Annalise Anderson, have published Reagan in his own hand. We see all the 700 essays that he wrote out in his own handwriting, and he's setting forth his views on all these matters, and this was before he was president. So he had thought rather carefully about many of these subjects before he went into office. And it always seemed to me people remarked on the fact that he had such a strong backbone on things, that the reason why he stood by his ideas was that he had thought them through, and he understood why he believed what he believed. And it wasn't because he put his finger up in the air and saw which way the wind was blowing. It's because long before he was president, he had thought about these matters and come to a conclusion about them.
You presumably provided a lot of the economic knowledge, which I know nothing about economics, of the whole period. Reagan presumably wasn't trained in economics.
Well, he was a pretty good economist in the sense that he understood broadly what was going on, and he had ideas that he stuck with. And I was his economic advisor before I was Secretary of State as a pro bono head of something called the Economic Policy Advisory Board. And I had a lot of good people, like Milton Friedman was a member, and so on. And we'd go about every couple of months and talk to him about economic matters. And it was very rewarding, I think, and helped him a lot. But when I was Secretary of State, I came back from a trip to Europe, my first stint, and I went and gave him a report. And he said, I know you're busy with the things of the Secretary of State, but you used to give me economic advice, and I don't want you to be stepping on the toes of the Secretary of the Treasury and so forth, but nevertheless, if you have any good ideas, I'd like to hear them. So I thought about that, and He came out here for vacation at Christmas time, and I came out. And I had a little talk with Bob Hall and Milton Friedman separately about what could be accomplished if you eliminated preferences in the tax system by way of reducing the marginal rate of taxation. And this would cause the economy to move forward very well. So I went down to the Annenbergs for a New Year's Eve party where he went. And on the December 31st, we had a golf game. It became a traditional golf game. And I said, I'd like a few minutes privately with you. I have an idea. You asked me for ideas. I've got an idea. So we retired to a little room by ourselves, and I said, there is a free lunch. And if you advocated eliminating all these preferences, you could have an equivalent of cutting the marginal rate of taxation. And the way they score these things, they assume that the economy doesn't change because of that. So you can make it come out even, but what will really happen is the economy will move forward rapidly as a result of these changes. And I have the authority of Milton Friedman and Bob Hall and other people in economics to that. So he liked that idea. And he said, why don't you, you're going back, why don't you tell that to Don Regan, who was the Secretary of the Treasury? And I did. And I said to Don, the President Will is interested in this, and I'm the messenger, and I'm out of it now. I'm not going to step on your toes, but if there's ever a cabinet meeting or anything where you're looking for support, you can count on me. So he developed that, and then Jim Baker, when he became Secretary, worked on it. And the 1986 Tax Act was exactly that. It took out a lot of preferences, reduced the marginal rates of taxation, and I think it's the unsung hero of the prosperity that we've had since then. So as you were saying earlier, President Reagan was a man who had clear views, but he was always looking out for new ideas, new information, and so on, and was willing, if he thought they were sound, to do something about it.
But you and he ran into a lot of opposition on these points. I mean, they sound almost obvious, even to illiterates like myself economically. But lots of people didn't believe it, partly because they believed that the sort of thing they had in Russia didn't quite the same thing. But it's not only in Russia, look at France. They're in the same position in some ways. They're denying roughly what you and
France is impossible.
And what people, and Orwell said quite clearly, people act differently in different countries. Different countries have different attitudes. France is different from England or America, and Russia is even more different. But they're both very different. They must be approached as quite different subjects. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine who was in the British Embassy in Paris, they allowed him to liaise with the French prefecture, the ministry, for some time. So he saw the some months. He said, it's like a Soviet system that works. Rather odd way of putting it.
You
will see what it means, that the actual machinery worked. Yeah. In Russia, not even the machinery worked. But these things are totally different from both the British and the American attitudes. Australia must be a frightful thing for the French to read about.
Australia is doing very well. And as a matter of fact, the ideas of a open market and private property, the rule of law, people are seeing that in different sized countries, different cultures, different religions, you do things more or less along those lines, and the economy tends to move forward, and people have seen that all over the world. It's a good lesson.
Well, when you talk of the rule of law, I think that is one of the real things that's forgotten more than anything else, much more important than, quote, democracy. And I noticed in Russia, the young liberals, who came out to distance and so on, they had manifestos about democracy, nothing about the rule of law. If they had the rule of law, they'd be far more ahead than the pseudo-democracy they have. And it still doesn't exist.
China has the same problem, although they grasp it and they're trying to move towards it. But I think you're right that without it, you don't know where you stand, and everything can become arbitrary. And in Russia right now, with the state taking such a hand, it doesn't seem to me, if I were considering a major investment in Russia, that I would feel very comfortable about it.
No, Russia's not doing well on that front. The rule of law, it's very odd that they can't seem to get that straight. Because one of the prime ministers who resigned a year or two ago said, he was asked, how can you have a Silicon Valley in Russia? And he said, by the state not doing anything. And they couldn't believe it. And he said this in public. It was reported in one of the Moscow papers. But they could, well, how do you mean this? You mean the state doesn't intervene in Silicon Valley? No.
No. I remember once when President Reagan in the primaries, and he asked me to organize some things on small business and so on, and I got some people from around here, and we had a meeting up in the Fairmont Hotel. And President Reagan turned to one of them and he said, and if I were president, what could I do for you? And the man said, leave us alone. But Silicon Valley's changed its mind now. They're lobbying Washington all over the place.
Too much of that. but the notion of the state doesn't, this notion of the state doing so much is a very, very Soviet and pre-Soviet and post-Soviet thing. Even if it's not at least attacking the entire world, it still wants to rule its own people in the old fashion and push them abroad to some extent.
But it's nevertheless an interesting question. How is it that the Soviet people nevertheless produce such creativity and such great works of art and such wonderful music and dance? And there's a streak of creativity there that's really quite impressive.
Well, I think I'd omit the word Soviet, the Russian people.
Mm-hmm.
But you're perfectly... The other thing, I remember going to ballet in then Leningrad, and I said, look, they're doing Swan Lake. Their feet are coming out exactly on, everything's exactly on time. What do you mean Russians can't keep time and do anything right? They were perfectly disciplined, controlled, doing exactly what was wanted. Why can't they do that in the economy?
I've had a theory on the creativity of science. I'll try out on you. And it is that if you have a culture where there are great creative artists in other fields, that it infects the scientists. And their instinct of creativity is greater as a result of that.
Like Sakharov.
And I've felt that like Sakharov, he's as good a physicist, I guess, as the world has seen, and yet he lived in this environment, and it was part of the creativity, and it led him to part company with his superiors on human rights matters.
I think it's true. I came across an odd thing. Sergei Vavilov, the physicist, the brother of a famous biologist who died in prison. There's a book called something about Marxism, the anniversary of Marxism, something or other, in about 1930. And his contribution said, it was a strange thing in Russia, even in the old Russia, before Peter the Great, there was not any no science, there wasn't any pseudoscience. How can we account for that? I don't know. But this is said publicly by a physicist. And he wasn't in trouble, except when his brother was in trouble. But that is an extraordinary thing to say about, to look back, and nobody was doing anything that even resembled or pretended to be a science till the 18th century.
But then it emerged, and
about good science.
You have to say they produced ballistic missiles, they produced nuclear weapons, whatever they may have done by spying. And I must say they were very good at putting bugs in walls and so on. There's a streak of creativity there.
They had to do it. But when they were doing, I think probably the same thing we said before, that when they... When you have an army in the old days, at least when you're producing something, the army can say, this doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Whereas Everyone else in the economy, nobody can say that. They have to take it. These tractors are too big, never mind.
Well, war for an army, war is a reality check. And you have to recognize what works and what doesn't work.
And it didn't work at the beginning of World War II when they found that some of the fighter planes didn't have the right range. And they weren't allowed to practice in bad weather. They did, the German and British Air Force, because if they did that in bad weather, they crashed and then somebody would be blamed for it. So the commanders said, wait, we won't fly in this weather. And then they had planes which only had a limited range. That's why in the Finnish War and in the early part of World War I, they were barely under-equipped. They'd done a huge amount of input. But they learned that during and after the war.
If you are constrained by the idea that you can't afford to fail, you never try anything, and you wind up falling back, failing.
That's what's the fault in Russian economy, basically.
It's among them. There are a lot of faults. But yet I keep coming back to the fact that there is this streak of creativity and drive that's impressive.
Oh, the Russian creativity is, I mean, when you read Chekhov or Pushkin or anybody, I gave a talk in, that's one of the troubles, in Petersburg once, and said, right, what I'd like to look forward to in Russia is free elections between Sokolovites and Solzhenitsynites. And these are intellectuals in the audience, and one of them said, yes, but one of them would win, yes. But then the other one wouldn't be right, he'd be wrong. Well, no, you haven't quite got the idea.
Yeah.
They still have to learn that. It was a curious, it's an odd experience with Russians.
You have, and you've been contributed immensely to our ability to work with them realistically by writing with such clarity and by laying it out for everybody to see who is willing to see.
Well,
and it had a big impact on Margaret Thatcher.
Yes.
And the Reagan-Thatcher relationship was a very productive one. I see we're getting a wave. And so we need to say, Bob, thank you so much for coming in and having this conversation. It's always fun to talk to you, and you're such a knowledgeable person. That's a special privilege.
Thank you, George. I had great fun.
Good.